Hey guys, this is Hunter Levine, and thank you for listening to the Captain's Collective podcast, brought to you by Skinny Water Culture, Hell's Bay Boatworks, and Orvis Fly Fishing. Well, it's my last interview in South Carolina for a while, and I'm really glad I got a chance to connect with today's guest, Jeremy Clark. Jeremy's an incredible photographer, father, and fisherman who began his pursuit of tailing redfish by wading out in a pair of old Chuck Taylors off the side of the road. And although Jeremy did run into a fish that day, he has come a long way and has an incredible knack for capturing those special moments in the marsh. In this episode, Jeremy and I discuss how to tackle difficult learning curves, the importance of appreciating the seemingly mundane, and the upside of abject failure, and also how an earthquake changed the trajectory of his life. I really appreciate Jeremy's thoughtfulness with these questions and walked away with a lot to think about. I hope that you enjoy. This is the Captain's Collective.
I'll say it's anything you choose, I think it picks you. You know, it's genetic.
Let everything else stop in the world and just be quiet. And it's amazing where your mind goes at that point and where it doesn't go. And sometimes just that quiet space is what we need, and especially in this day and age.
If you have a fly rod in your hand, it's this tool that takes you to beautiful places. You meet hopefully wonderful people. And it's just this cherry on top of this outdoor adventure.
When the fish is coming, that shot within a shot, that timer starts.
Beep, 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 beep.
No one else knew anything anyway, and you're just definitely making it up as you're going along. But
so what Grandpa and Dad would tell me is like, all right, where's the old big trout laying out there? Where's his shaving cream on the water? Where's he been shaving this morning? So look for his shaving cream on the water, and that's where he's going to be.
Hey, Jeremy, thanks for hanging out with us on the podcast. Man, I followed your work for a long time here and the photography that you've done, and I love the video that you did with Fly Lords. I thought that was such a powerful story and really moving, and I'm excited to talk about your career and your family and fishing with you. But before we get into all that, do you mind just giving us the background of how you first fell in love with the outdoors?
Hey, Hunter. Yeah. First, thanks for having me. It's excited to be on your podcast here. I grew up in Virginia, kind of out in the middle of nowhere, little tiny town. And really just that's where we played. You know, we played in the outdoors, did a bunch of fishing and hunting growing up, all pretty low key stuff, you know, farm ponds for bass and catfishing in the lake and things like that. I never really fly fished until quite a bit later on. I grew up with all that around me. We lived on 5 acres and it was, surrounded by woods. You know, our closest neighbor was about a quarter mile away. So, you know, we spent quite a bit of time outside. My brother and I, and then I had a sister who was quite a bit younger than myself, and, sort of put that on hold a little bit, when I joined the Marine Corps right out of high school. And, of course we were still outdoors then, but just in a bit of a different capacity. So yeah, I mean, it kind of got instilled very young. My family hunted quite a bit. They fished some, but mostly it was hunting that they did.
Yeah, and in the Marine Corps, did you move around quite a bit during that season, or what did that season of life look like?
Yeah, so I had two main duty stations that I was at, but one of which I spent quite a bit of time deployed overseas. And so that was just a little challenging. And then it was just really, there was no excuse not to be continuing to do the outdoor things that I loved, except for, you know, I was a young, dumb Marine and we just hung out and partied all the time. That was the, that was the MO for that little period of my life.
And so what did it look like transitioning from your time in the service, just back into, for lack of a better phrase, civilian life and kind of reconnecting with the outdoors? What did that season look like?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. You know, my wife and I were both Marines. We didn't get married till right after we got out, but I did almost 10 years in and decided to get out. And that was kind of a big decision you know, a lot of people told me, you're crazy. You're halfway to retirement. And, you know, I like to put it like this. I had my fun with the Marine Corps. They certainly had their fun with me, and we parted on good terms. So it was just my time to go. And, mm-hmm. Yeah, when I got out and, you know, took a job, it was scary at first, of course, you know, just a kind of a big change and sort of an unknown. And, but once we did that, I found out, you know, I've got all this free time and really started to reconnect, with some new stuff. You know, I grew up in freshwater, like I said, in farm ponds in kind of the middle of Virginia, and the saltwater scene was completely and utterly new to me. And I was fascinated with speckled trout more than anything at the time, and redfish, of course, as well. So it was easier to get back into fishing at that time because there was so much public water access and not quite as much public land access that I was familiar with. So I gravitated towards that more than getting back into hunting right off, and that sort of took on and into its own thing. And, you know, I didn't start fly fishing. You know, I fly fish a lot now, almost that's about all I do anymore. And that didn't start until I got to Charleston. I picked up a fly rod after the very first time. I talked to a shop around here and kind of heard about this tailing redfish thing, and, you know, said, man, that looks like fun. Let me try that. And, I felt like I got led astray right at first with some info, because I think I got directions wrong and ended up, you know, over hip deep in some pluff mud water with, you know, grass growing up head high, and just didn't know what I was doing, and kind of reset and went back again the next day, and, you know, stumbled out into the marsh and had no idea what I was doing and thought, this is ridiculous. And right then, a redfish tailed 25 feet from me, and I just froze, and I didn't know what to do. I had a spinning rod and a Johnson's Gold Spoon on, and he swam around behind me just a couple of feet behind me. And once he passed me, I flipped him that spoon, and he ate it and took off and came unbuttoned. I didn't catch that fish. And I don't know what it was, but for some reason I thought, I want to do this with a fly rod, having zero experience with a fly rod ever in my life. And that's when I picked it up.
Yeah. I joke with people often that, you know, you think about that story and you think, how can I make this situation harder?
Yeah. What can I do to make this way more difficult?
Were you wade fishing? I mean, was it just, here's a kid that grew up in Virginia, went off in the Marines, and now you find yourself in Charleston, South Carolina. Did you just wade out there with a spinning rod, or how did that look?
That's it. I pulled off on the side of the road where someone kind of said, you know, you might be able to access right here. So I pulled off on the side of the road with a pair of sneakers and a spinning rod at hand. And, you know, I didn't make it 50 feet from the bank before I saw this fish. So it was pretty fortunate. I mean, I could have been wandering around forever not knowing what in the world I was doing. So part of what I love about it is, you know, you can get as fancy as you want to with these fish, or you can have an old pair of Chuck Taylors, you know, an extra fly in your pocket, and just park on the side of the road and walk out and find these things. It's, you know, wow. You can overcomplicate it as much as you want, but it's pretty special that way.
Yeah. And I'm excited to talk more just about kind of how fishing has become a big part of your life, but where did the photography piece come in? Because I first found out about you, somebody had brought some photos to my attention and said, man, you need to check these out. I think you're really going to like these. And, man, I fell in love with your photography. I thought it was just capturing these moments so well. Where did the photo piece come in for you?
Thanks, man. You know, I think I've always enjoyed sharing. Like, I'm a storyteller. You know, all my friends, they've got this thing. They think they're hilarious because I'll tell a story, and if I tell it more than once, they hold up fingers for how many times they've heard it. You know, so I've always loved storytelling, and I think it sort of evolved into, you know, I'm trying to do this sort of long distance with people back home, with things I'm seeing, you know, in the Marine Corps and things that I'm seeing, you know, having sort of gotten out of my small town in Virginia and sharing it with family and friends back home. And it was just a really convenient way to be able to sort of back up the stories I'm telling, not as far as, you know, verifying the information, but more of, it's just much more descriptive. You know, I could tell a story about how I did, you know, just what I told you about the first redfish there. But if I don't accompany that with, you know, photos of the marsh and what that was like, and sort of, I feel like it rounds out the, you know, the experience. So it kind of just, it took hold in that way, and was just a very serious hobby for a long time, with a point and shoot camera for a very, very long time, and sort of just took off from there. It's always just been about sharing a moment, you know, just wanting to capture that and, you know, be able to put it out there to people that have similar interests. Yeah.
What was harder for you beginning? Like, was it getting into fly fishing or was it getting into photography? Because those are two kind of challenging learning curves there.
Yeah. They're probably neck and neck, to be honest. You know, when I got my first fly rod, it's like a Cabela's rod or something. I don't even remember. And I got a kayak and I would kayak to flats and get out and walk. And I had no idea what I was doing. I didn't take casting lessons. I didn't do anything. The only time I would really cast is when I saw a redfish, which was very infrequently. So, you know, practice was very few and far between. And I broke off about 18 inches at the tip of that rod and never did anything about it. So I fished with a, you know, an 8-weight that was supposed to be 9 feet long, but it was only 7 feet and a couple inches or something for, you know, 2 years, just figuring it out. And, you know, it wasn't very far off with the photography either. You know, I had a lot of bad habits that I know now, but I didn't know then. And it's just, you know, after just sort of having both of those things in your hands for long enough and sort of having them everywhere with you, you know, you kind of figure those out. And I had a lot of help along the way, people that kind of would give tips and things, but both were pretty painful journeys kind of from the get-go.
Yeah, I definitely see there being a correlation between the two. Have you always just enjoyed the challenge or the journey of learning something new?
Yeah, I do. And, you know, I never really did much further education, organized education after high school. But I do love learning new things. I've always got my plate full with something else I want to do. With way too many things, but certainly, you know, challenging myself with something new and rounding it out, fleshing that out, I guess, you know, certainly feels good. I don't want to do things that I'm not good at. And so the things I choose to do, I try to do those very well.
What tips could you give to somebody who's maybe at the very beginning of photography or fly fishing or just any type of thing that they want to be good at, but there's a big learning curve?
Yeah. You know, I think the best way to get over a big learning curve is to overwhelm it with your attention. So, you know, if you're into photography, and I get quite a few, you know, questions, you know, what camera should I get and what this and what that, and, you know, it's really about, I think it's really about developing your own voice, and making sure that you're passionate about what you're doing. So, if, you know, for instance, I get a lot of questions about photography, and my response is almost always, you know, you want to have equipment that you can manipulate yourself. So you want something with manual controls, so that the camera isn't forcing your creativity one way or another. And you also want to put that thing in your hands and carry it everywhere with you. Take photos of everything that you're passionate about. Just use it all the time until it, you know, becomes an extension of your arm. And at that point you'll develop your own voice. And I think, you know, if you're passionate about something, it resonates with other people. because they can really sort of glean that off of whatever you're producing. You know, if you're and that goes with anything, not just photography. I think, you know, if you're passionate about cooking, it shows, you know, and I think that's the biggest thing, is to overwhelm the subject at hand with your presence. So just be there all the time.
When you look back at your life, what do you feel like were the most influential things in your voice and shaping your voice?
That's a good question. I grew up, you know, pretty far out in the middle of nowhere. We didn't have much. We grew up pretty poor. And so, you know, moving away from that, I feel like I maybe appreciate the mundane. I don't know if that even really makes sense, but I'd like to think that I appreciate the authenticity of the moment. And so what's happening right now is very, very important, because it's you can't relive that. And so I try to make the best of that right now. And, you know, I did have some events in my life that, you know, made a significant impact. And probably two of the most things is, I was in a pretty serious earthquake in Christchurch, New Zealand in 2011. And, you know, probably shouldn't have made it out of that. We were trapped in a high-res building that was collapsing for quite a few hours and some various things. And, that was a pretty significant life-changing moment. Just really solidified, you know, the fact that time is fleeting, and you know, if you don't move on the things that you want to, you know, tomorrow is not assured. And that sounds really cliche, but it's, you know, when you're really faced with something like that, and there's everybody, you know, lots of people have tons of experiences like that, but it really kind of puts things into perspective. And the second thing I think, and they're kind of tied together, is, you know, my wife and I were not able to have our own kids, and something we really wanted was to start our family. And, you know, the earthquake experience really kind of woke us up and said, all right, we're, you know, we've been doing this on our own for long enough. It's, you know, it's time to, you know, bring in some help, whatever that is. So, you know, let's go to the clinic and see what's going on and see what we can do and see what the doctors say. And, you know, it ended up with adoption, and it's, you know, it's awesome. You know, my two kids are both adopted, and they're a tremendous part of my life. And I think those things sort of, both of those events sort of drive home to me that, you know, you've got to make the most of the time that you have.
When you're 25 stories up and you're caught in an earthquake and you're thinking that you're never going to get out again, what are the thoughts racing through your mind in that moment?
Yeah, it's funny. You don't think about anything that you think is important today. I think it really sort of trims the fat, so to speak. And so when I was up there, and we were, pretty much everybody that was trapped in there with me, we were reserved to the fact that we only had a few moments or, you know, hours left on the earth. And, I wanted to speak to my wife, to tell her I loved her, and I wanted to start a family. That was it. Now, you know, you don't think about, gosh, I got to get the oil changed on the truck. You know, I'm running behind on that, or I got to do this. You know, none of that stuff matters. It certainly was a wake up call. It absolutely, you know, was a wake up call.
If that hadn't have happened, where do you think you would be? Like, what was the trajectory, I guess, if that had never come into play?
You know, I hate to say this. I don't think I've ever really thought about that before, but, you know, if the trajectory would have remained the same, I wonder if we would have adopted at least on the same course that we did. Mm-hmm. You know, we always imagined that we would adopt children You know, we just never envisioned it would be our first. So possibly the I would have ended up in a similar situation, just delayed a bit. You know, that that really kind of got us moving to towards adoption or towards figuring what figuring out what we needed to do.
And I love the way that you put it, you know, to trim the fat. Like when you think about life, what was some of the fat that got trimmed away from that moment?
Virtually everything. And, you know, that not once did I think, I'm not going to be able to watch Netflix again. You know, I'm not going to, I never once thought, I'm never going to be able to fly fish again. You know, none of that stuff mattered. The things that, even things that I'm, you know, I'm very passionate about, you know, it was, it really all came down to family, just period. You know, I wanted to be around with my family and to see my family grow and, you know, to be with loved ones. And, you know, that's, you know, when it comes down to it, you know, people matter. You know, if you don't, you know, and if you can't sort of recognize that, you know, I feel like, you know, you have a real obstacle to maybe growing in your own life. So
you had mentioned that your upbringing in Virginia and just kind of being in a more rural environment helped you to appreciate the mundane. And that's something that I've noticed and kind of really appreciated about some of the things that you share and try to put out there is just these, I guess you could sometimes call them the in-between moments, you know, of, I think a lot of times in the outdoor industry, there can be a temptation, just it's all grip and grins. It's all high action, you know, and I've noticed that you really have made a priority to try to kind of slow things down and appreciate these little moments. And I would imagine that even though, you know, a lot of things start to fall into a different priority slot in your life, that when you come back from an experience like that and you start a family and then you engage in going out on the water or going out to a place in the outdoors that you love, that it changes the way you see it. In what ways did that life altering experience change the way that you engaged with the outdoors?
You know, probably the same way it did with everything is just it drives an appreciation, you know, for, and maybe mundane, the way I said it earlier is not the right word. Maybe more appropriately, it's the seemingly mundane, you know, because you can gloss over the little things. You know, some of my favorite times that I've had since, and I don't know that I would have, you know, been able to slow down and recognize these sort of things without something like what I went through happening to me. You know, for instance, you pull up in the marsh and the tide's done and it's dropping out and you're just kind of sitting back with whoever you're on the skiff with and, you know, rehashing some memories of what happened that time or just hanging out, being quiet. And when you do, you know, you look around you and you get to see that, the marsh is just alive, like all the way down to the teeny tiny little pinpoint sized spiders that crawl around the Spartina, you know, and the periwinkle snails. And one of my favorite things to do is to break out a macro lens, and we're sitting still and the tide's dropping and the, you know, grass is getting taller beside the boat and there's just critters all around, and sort of really taking a close look at those things. And you know, when I do, I find myself going home and researching the things that I've taken photos of, because I realize I don't know much about these things at all. And I've learned quite a bit about the marsh just by doing that. And I think it's those quiet moments that are easily overshadowed by, like you said, a grip and grin. You know, that's not my favorite part of the day. But one of my favorite things to shoot, you know, is abject failure. Abject failure just speaks volumes above, you know, being in the winner's circle. And it's a whole different type of emotion. you know, and maybe a little more visceral. So yeah, I really enjoy that.
Yeah, explain to me abject failure. What's the case for appreciating abject failure?
So, a trip that you've put tons of time, maybe a lot of your finances into, and all these things, and it culminates in this tremendous moment where, you know, the scales can tip one way or another, and you've got the fish of a lifetime on, and a gear failure or just anything happens, and in the blink of an eye, it's over. And the instant that happens, there's something in the people that are experiencing that, you know, the way they react to that, it's just visceral. And it's great to see. I mean, you hate to see people essentially fail, but it's a fantastic thing to catch, you know, as far as photography.
Yeah. Especially when you're behind the camera.
Right. When you're not the one. Yeah. When you're the one that loses the fish of a lifetime or something, of course, that's not very fun. And it's probably not fun having a camera in your face when that's happening to you. But,
I have a friend who, Marty over at Bad Fish, they filmed a video series and they had a lot of abject failure in that. He wouldn't mind me saying that. And I appreciated it as somebody watching it because I feel like it's so easy to edit out, for lack of a better phrase, all the mess ups, the bad casts, the blown shots, the just times where the fish didn't. You edit all that out in this kind of maybe in some ways overproduced world we live in. And it can sometimes, I think, impact other people's experience because when they put on their sneakers for the first time and they wade out there and they blow a shot or comes unbuttoned or whatever, and they're thinking, well, it doesn't seem like anybody else that comes unbuttoned. Well, it does all the time, but they've edited it out. It kind of leads me to a question I had, which is, as somebody who's in the media side of things and photography, what responsibility do you feel like people in the media side of the industry have in trying to help be authentic and for those who are new or struggling, see a more holistic picture of the outdoor experience?
Yeah. That's a really good point. You know, I think it's all a highlight reel. Anything you're seeing is just a highlight reel. No matter what your method of consumption is, you know, for the most part, you're seeing someone's highlight reel. And comparison is, you know, one of the thieves of joy. And everybody's vulnerable to that. You know, I certainly am. And it's, I think there is an inherent duty for people to be authentic in that realm. You know, I get a lot of questions all the time. You know, I wish I could fish every day like you do and things like that. And I try to be very real with people and say, that's not reality. You know, I'm sharing moments that I enjoy, but you know, I work at a desk and, you know, I answer emails all day long kind of thing. I do quite a bit of that as well. You know, and I think that's across the board. That's not just in, you know, photography or fly fishing. There's certainly an inherently bad thing with misrepresenting your life, and I think it comes honestly as, you know, you just want to share things that you're excited about and share things that are good that are happening, and the thing that we don't see is that could, you know, negatively affect someone else's opinion of themselves or their experience. And so, you know, I don't think about it very often, but, you know, maybe showing the seemingly mundane is a great way to sort of combat that.
Yeah, I think that's good. Something that you and I have in common is we're both Christians and we're both people of faith. And with this podcast, I try to interview people and, in my terms, get out of the way. I want to interview somebody and it actually be about the person I'm interviewing and what they think and how they communicate. And I can tell that to you, faith is an important part of your life. And in what way has faith shaped your family, your life, and the way that you engage in fishing?
That's a good question. Well, I certainly believe that, you know, specifically and you know, going back to the earthquake, there's something that I'm meant to accomplish here in this world, and that's one of the reasons that I was spared. Not so sure that I know what that is. Maybe it's to, you know, be a dad to these two little kids. Maybe that's something different. I'm not really sure, but I wholeheartedly believe in that. And, you know, the story of the earthquake gets pretty long. I won't get into that, but there was a moment there where certainly there was a supernatural intervention that kept me here. And, so that's maybe the most obvious or poignant, you know, one, but you know, just the everyday things, you know, learning to, you know, to love people the way that you're supposed to, and, to instill that into your kids, and, you know, to bring them up in the way that they're going to, you know, be constructive, and they're going to be, you know, caring people, and that they're going to, you know, have an impact, you know, all of their own. You know, it's hard to raise little kids. And I know there's a ton of people out there have kids, and you do as well, that understand this. You know, your job is to raise them to become independent. And that's really hard to do, because you don't want them to be independent. You want them to kind of, you know, come running to Papa for things all the time. So it's really, you know, it's really driven that. It's, you know, it's been a bulkhead of, you know, of our marriage, you know, me and my wife's marriage. And so, yeah, it's, I guess it's always lingering there, you know, and I certainly struggle with that sometimes. And a lot of times with expressing that, but, it's always there, and it's a pretty solid foundation. I think maybe the most solid foundation that you can build upon.
Yeah. And I, you know, we've talked about this some too, but one of my daughters is adopted. And, I remember when we were fostering her, there would just be times where I'd come home from like a long day of work, and I get home and she was asleep, and I didn't know what was going to happen with her life and what was going to be the next chapter of her life. But in that moment, that, I guess to use your terminology, that seemingly mundane moment of just holding my child, I remember having some of the most emotional breakdown, tearful moments holding her that I've ever felt in my life. And what I felt was just this love for this child that I never thought that I could experience. And I was an only child too, so I didn't have younger siblings, and, you know, didn't grow up around a lot of kids. And just holding her and knowing how much I love her, and then just to think that this is the love that God feels for me, you know, this robust God who has created the ecosystem of the marsh, from the, yeah, you know, the bugs, the little bugs on the Spartina grass, to the fish eating them, to the whole cycle. And I think that that's, to me, like, when I watched your video, that I thought the Fly Lords video was really just well done, and really touched on something that maybe gets overlooked a lot in the fishing industry, and that's the family, you know, the unit behind the people who fish. And I thought, man, it was just so powerful just to see the love of a father. Tell me about that day of filming and going out with Z, and tell us about the day, the behind the scenes of that.
That was fun. So, you know, Jared and Max, you know, they come to town, and, you know, they're just a hoot anyways, but we get out on the water, you know, I think we had 3 days and, you know, three good flood tides, and day one we get out and it just doesn't really happen. And then day two, we have Z out on the boat, and he's loving it. He's a ham, you know, he's just absolutely having a ball. He's what, 3 years old at the time or something. And, we had, like, you know, I never have tippet failures, knock on wood. We had, I think we hooked four fish that came unbuttoned and or broke, had a bad tippet spool, all these things, like, you know, wanted, here we are, here I am talking about, you know, no hero shots. Well, we wanted one hero shot for the film. And it literally came down to like the last 15 minutes of the tide on the last day. So that was a lot of fun. Z still talks about Jared and Max and Max's camera, and he loves it. But you know, we had, you know, my buddy Luke and my buddy Mike, you know, out to help out and kind of pull us around. And I mean, we just had a good time. I mean, the next morning after the first day, you know, I kept telling him, Z, we're going to go fishing with the boys. And, you know, he'd wake up and say, Papa, we going fishing with the boys? I said, yeah, we are. And he'd say, am I the boys? I'm like, you are the boys. You are one of the boys, dude. You are an integral part of this whole thing. And, yeah, we just had a blast. I mean, we, you know, we went, you know, till dark both days with Z. And the big Ravenel Bridge, that goes, over the harbor in Charleston, you know, we're riding back. It's pitch dark and, you know, two skiffs. And my buddy Luke, who's driving mine, I'm holding Z, he says, you want to go run, check out the bridge? It's lit up. It's beautiful. And I don't think I'd ever stopped underneath it at night in a really calm night. And there's a serious echo under that. And so Z calls it the Echo Bridge now. And, you know, we spent 35 minutes, you know, two boats drifting underneath the bridge, you know, all of us yelling back and forth, echoes to each other. And just, I mean, Z ate it up. He ate it up. And, you know, it was really great working with those guys and, you know, kind of seeing the end result. I've got a pretty rad, like, home movie, you know, to show people when I'm 80 years old or something. You know, look at Z when he was little and these things he did. So it was fun. It was stressful because, you know, we talk up Charleston and here I couldn't put a fish in the boat, but it happened. We made it happen.
Well, to you, I'd love to talk a little bit about, you know, photography and how that's influenced your fishing and vice versa, you know. So it seems like, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, that you got pretty serious about fishing and got really serious about the business of photography around the same time. Is that right?
Fishing first, or fly fishing came first, I think. And then I started to get relatively serious about photography. And it didn't really turn into any sort of a business venture until we really started looking at shooting weddings. And I was, I was on the, my wife and I were both part of a pretty big church here in Charleston. And, we worked in the teen ministry, and it was a huge, huge, huge group of teens we worked with. There was another couple in town that were amazing wedding photographers. And they approached me and said, hey, listen, we hear you're a photographer. We feel overly blessed with, you know, being able to do this thing that we love for a living. And we want to see if there's anybody else that kind of wants to see what it's all about and if they could do it. And, you know, I first thought, wedding photography sounds awful. You know, it sounds stressful and all these things. But I could probably learn a lot. And, you know, I was just, you know, he says, well, bring a portfolio and we'll have a look at your work and we'll see. And I'm like, I don't have a portfolio. I don't know what this guy's talking about. And, you know, I ended up going and, you know, good friends with those guys now, and they kind of really kicked things off for us. And the very first wedding I sort of attended with them, you know, I realized I was really ignorant in my previous assumption of that. Yes, it's a big responsibility. Yes, there's a lot of stress involved, but it's a really, really cool time to be involved in somebody else's life. You know, you get kind of a, you know, behind the scenes access to, you know, the mood's infectious at a wedding, you know, and so we love that. And that really sort of drove the business side. And so, I mean, we shoot quite a bit of weddings, and, you know, of course I shoot a lot of other stuff too. But it really all, the business side kind of started with wedding photography.
How do you feel like those two things, fishing and photography, have maybe in some ways, for lack of a better phrase, synergized with each other and helped one another kind of progress?
That's a good question. Certainly shooting outdoors, you know, and sort of in the moment, you know, with fly fishing. So, you know, making things happen, or capturing things as they happen, I should say, and being in the moment was really good training, unintentionally, but was really good training for, you know, shooting weddings. There's not a lot of stage stuff that we do. Most of it is just sort of being there and being aware. And you know, that happens a lot with the outdoor stuff that I love to shoot. You know, I shoot, of course, fly fishing mostly, but, you know, I do a little bit of hunting photography and some various things. And all of those sort of require you to see something and be able to manipulate the scene so that it's as authentic as possible, but also aesthetically pleasing. You know, you've sort of got to be able to see the scene and know what you want to get out of it. And, you know, sometimes you just kind of fall right on your face on that. And sometimes you got to work pretty hard for it. So it's, you know, just all depends on each individual moment. But I think certainly combining those two things and with the volatility of time, you know, so if you do get that, you know, you do get that chance with a fish to have some photos with it and all, it's very fleeting. You know, you do it really, really quickly so that you, you know, get that fish back on his way and somebody else can come catch him. And that was really good unintentional training for being able to have, you know, one shot, make it count at this wedding stuff that we do.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Yeah, that's a great explanation. If it's good with you, I'd love to get into a section I call not so rapid fire questions.
Yeah.
I've never successfully accomplished rapid fire questions, although I've always just enjoyed. Don't feel the need to speed anything up here.
Okay.
But I do have this is just my excuse for my laundry list of questions that don't flow. So what advice would you give to somebody who is in the outdoors and wants to start taking photography? What is the essential starter kit, must know first, this is what you need to do by, think, in the first year?
Okay, first year. I think you need to start out with a camera that you can manipulate manually. So make sure that it has a manual control. And although you're going to mess a lot of things up in manual control right off the bat, that's going to be the crash course. You're going to learn more than you could ever imagine by doing that. And keep it in your hand and shoot all the time. And I think, like I said earlier, shoot what you're passionate about, and it will resonate with the people that you're showing this to. The first year. That's really it. I mean, you've got to be solid in knowing what you want to capture. And as soon as you can, you know, have that camera as that tool that you have as sort of an extension of your arm, and you don't have to think about that anymore, then you're going to be able to accomplish that. Hmm.
Yeah, that's a good parallel too. The idea of it being an extension of your arm. It seems like the people I fish with that are the best anglers, that's kind of how the rod is with them, conventional and hand fly fishing. You know, obviously shooting in the outdoors and in the elements and in the environment lends itself to a lot of gear destruction. What is the worst story of messing up gear that you have?
Oh gosh. Okay. I've been very fortunate. I haven't had a lot, but I have two definitely like complete destruction that stand out. And I'm pretty hard on my gear. It is professional gear. It is built to withstand the elements, and I am a taskmaster when it comes to that kind of thing. I will put it to the test. But I have had my camera gear. We were going down to an Everglades trip, and we had ordered a new lens that I wanted to use on that trip through Amazon Prime. Well, they had an unexpected delay, and I didn't get it in time. But a coworker had just bought the exact same lens, brand new. And I said, look, man, you know I take care of my gear. Let me borrow it. And he was hesitant, but he did. I said, I'm going to take care of it. So we go down to the Everglades. We're in the backcountry. We're off the West Cape there, or off East Cape on the West Coast. And it's early morning, and there's tarpon rolling all around us, and we're staked out, and I was taking a couple of pictures, and my buddy hooked up on the bow, and I set the camera down, and when I had my Ginu, I had C-Deck on the platform, and it was a safe place to set a camera. It's not going to slide. Luke's boat was brand new. He was fishing a new Kayo, and he did not have C-Deck on the platform yet, so it's just a little thin piece of fiberglass with gel coat up there. So I set it down. We maneuver over to the side of the boat. The boat tips. I hear it slide. I swipe for it and miss it, and it goes about 12 feet deep. We're in about 12 feet of water in, murky water off the glades right at dawn. And I couldn't bring myself to go in the water after it. We had been seeing over the course of days, a bunch of sharks and just all kinds of things. And I'm like, I can't do that. I can't swim down in the dark and fumble around. There's no way. And I had caught, so the day prior, I had caught my biggest snook I will ever catch and my biggest tarpon I will ever catch. And it was all on that camera. And, and Luke tells me that. He's like, dude, you got to go get it. I'm like, I don't think I can. And so I took a rod out of the holder and took the hook and reeled it all the way up to the tip. So there's just a tiny little, a little tarpon hook right in the tip guide on the rod. And we were staked out, and I could see, so the camera started bubbling. So there was little fizzy bubbles coming up where it was flooding with water. And I stick the rod down to touch the bottom, thinking I can maybe grapple it, as a last ditch effort to trying to feel around the dark in the bottom of that water. And I couldn't even touch bottom. I thought, oh no. So I readjust and I lean down, and I've got like my head in the water and leaning as far as I can. And the rod tip hits the bottom, and I go to like swirl it around, and I can't. Well, I pick it up. I had hooked the strap. So I got it up. I separated everything. I laid it on a towel, waited, hopefully it would dry. Take the cards out. The battery, took it out. It was swelling up. It was going to bust. We put that away. And one of the two cards survived, and I got the pictures off of it. But I had to buy a brand new lens. I had to buy another lens for my buddy who had just dropped his brand new lens in the water and ruined it. And
Are those photos special? Or yeah. Are they a reminder of a not so good time?
No, they're special. We've got a joke on that same boat. So that same trip, I lost an iPhone, and then other people have donated quite a few electronics, off of that specific boat, and we've got the joke running that it demands a penance, that boat does, an electronic penance, and so there's that. And then in a subsequent trip, we were in the Keys. And a buddy of mine had just rebuilt a 1991, I think, Hughes Bonefisher 16-foot. And it was a beautiful boat. He did a great job for it. And we shoot up to Robbie's right before dark to go up there and just go grab a drink. And I'm like, hey, man, I'll run the drone. We'll get some shots of this new-to-you boat you just finished before this trip. And he's like, great. So we go up, and we're running, and I'm filming while it's running, and we clear the cut we were going through, and I made sure it was clear, and I slide down to come in right behind the boat and get a cool video, because I was like straight up overhead, and I think I caught the last mangrove branch that was sticking out, and I'm literally looking at the screen, and it's almost dark, and I just see leaves and branches, and then the spiral, and then nothing. And we went back and tried to find that thing, and we could not find that thing to save our lives. So I don't have any of that. But those are probably my two biggest gear mishaps. Oh, and when I was in Antarctica one time, I set down a 70-200 Canon L lens, which is white. I set it down amongst all these pressure ridges where the Ross Sea kind of butts up against Ross Island, and the tide makes these giant kind of crashing wave formations out of the ice. And there were some seals around and things, and so we were kind of wandering around that, and I set it down to change lenses, which I never do. And I wandered off, and like 2 hours later, I realized I'm missing my white lens down here in the middle of the sastrugi and the pressure ridges in the ice in Antarctica. And I found it. I retraced my steps and got it.
Wow.
But yeah, I thought that one was gone. I'm never going to see that one again.
Yeah, you're going to have to put some neon tape on that next time.
Right.
Well, that kind of leads me to a question I had jotted down, which is I know that you love being a part of the Charleston community, and I've interviewed a few Charleston guides by this point and talked a decent bit with Paul Puckett, who speaks really high of you. And I know that you love being a part of that local community, but I also know that you have to travel a lot just between photography and then that you enjoy traveling with fishing. Talk to me about managing the tension between traveling and trying to keep local community.
Yeah, I'm not even sure I do that very well, but I'm typically out of the country for a few months a year. And so, you know, I get essentially 9 months at home. And so trying to fit everything into that time when I'm home every year is, it's definitely challenging, you know, and, you know, working essentially two full-time jobs and still being able to recreate and then see all the people that you want to see and everything. It's a balancing act. I'm not sure I pull it off so well. There's certainly a lot of people that I want to see more often, and there's just not time, you know. So I'm not sure if that really even answers your question, but that's what it is.
It's a good honest answer.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna, as you know, we're kind of slowly running out of time here. I want to hear a story about what makes one of these two places so great, and I want you to pick one, and then the next time that we do an interview, we'll circle back and talk about the other one.
Okay, great.
So tell me about either traveling to Antarctica or fishing New Zealand, your choice.
Let's talk about New Zealand this time. How about that?
That sounds great. That's what I was hoping.
Oh, good. Okay. All right. Yeah, I've been going down there for many years, and just, you know, for work. So essentially it's passing through, but I take some time to get out and enjoy it. And it's, you know, it's one of those places where if you've ever considered going or thought it's a place you would like to go visit, I would suggest to bump it up a few levels and put it, if not at, then right near the top of your list. It's a phenomenal place. Most of my time I've spent on the South Island. The people are fantastic. The weather is great. You know, the weather can be pretty severe one end or the other, just because of where it's located. But and of course, you know, if you're a fly fisherman, it is a world class trout destination. It's been quite there's a lot of water there, but it's been, I don't want to say it's overfished, but there's a lot of attention on it, you know, in recent years. And so you do have some company on the water sometimes, and at least compared to New Zealand standards, but it's a really technical fishery. I'm not a trout guy. And so it was incredibly challenging for me to sort of figure that out and go with it. You know, you're not fishing water so much as you're fishing to specific individual fish. There are places where you can, you know, you fish seams and you do that and you can be productive, but for the most part, you're doing a lot of walking and not very much swinging a fly rod, which is really kind of enjoyable. And, you know, something that I really love about how we fish saltwater with skiffs and, you know, kind of in a team, I enjoy team sports like that. I like being part of something where someone else is also a part of it. And New Zealand is very much the same. You know, when you're on a skiff with somebody, whether you're up front or, you know, you're poling, you know, you're part of a team and you're both sort of responsible for the success or that abject failure, you know, that I was talking about earlier. And it's very similar in New Zealand. You know, you're going to be most effective, you know, as part of a group or a part of a pair. And so, you've got a lot of help. You know, you don't always get to fish in the greatest spotting conditions, but that's what you try to maximize. And so you try to use elevation and sun angles to your advantage based on what side of the river you're going to be walking, you know, and you're really just inspecting water really heavily. And having someone there to, you know, once you spot a fish, you know, if you're, let's say you're up on a high bank on one side and you can see them, when you get down behind that fish and get lined up with them, you might not be able to see them at all. And so having somebody is like, you know, an integral part of the team there that's guiding you into that and calling shots and helping you out. It's just a lot of fun, you know. And then at the end of the day, you get to spend, you know, you spend a meal together and, you know, make backcountry espresso and, you know, just whatever it is that you do. And so it's a really great place to be. I've really enjoyed the time I've been able to spend there in the last number of years. I haven't done a proper trip as far as like taking a chunk of time off in a little while. So it's sort of fishing around the work day, which is still pretty hard to complain about.
Absolutely. You got me sold.
Yeah. Right. Oh yeah. It's yeah. It, if you're hearing this, then you should put it on your list of someplace to go. It's phenomenal.
Another question, you know, you've had the chance to fish with a lot of different anglers. By your assessment, what makes a great angler?
Someone that's okay with not being his best. You know, if you can, to be the most successful angler, as far as, well, I guess success can be measured in, you know, against many different rulers, but if you're talking about success as far as accomplishing your goal of catching fish, then I think people are most successful when they're not so hard on themselves. You know, and anybody can, you know, have a couple of bad experiences, whether they were under their control or not. You know, the fish didn't act the way it needed to, or the wind is just awful that day or something, and it gets in your head and you get behind an account and, you know, you're done and you just need a break. And I think that the people that are lighthearted about the entire ordeal, A, they enjoy it more than others, and B, they're also more successful with it.
So same question, but what makes great photographers?
I think someone that's not afraid to, I don't say risk at all. You're not really risking at all in, you know, in photography. You don't get one image, it's not the end of the world, I guess, just depending on what capacity you're shooting. But, you know, it's hard to describe. I think someone that you can tell that they were not manipulative of a situation, that they were just present and sort of bided their time, you know, for knowing that something was going to happen, sort of being able to read a situation and go for that. Or if it's something that they sort of designed in their head and set up beforehand, if it was a really high risk shot, like, you know, and I say quite a bit, even when we do like weddings and all, I'm like, hey, I've got an idea. I don't even know if this is going to work. This might be a horrible idea, but if you're game, let's try this. And we try it. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, it comes out, you know, amazingly. But it's sort of really treading that edge of, you know, this is just absolutely not going to work and be maybe a small waste of time. But you don't ever want to put something in somebody's memory. Like, I remember when he said specifically, let's try this. And then like, where is that? What happened to that image? And like, yeah, it wasn't good.
Sorry about your special day.
Sorry about putting that expectation on you. But yeah, I think it's someone that's able to be as authentic as they possibly can, and someone that's not afraid to take risks as far as, you know, breaking the rules of photography.
So you do a lot of small skiff fishing, and I've just noticed that you've always had the most interesting things on your skiff. From what I found most interesting was a pizza oven.
Yeah.
To turtle box speakers. Give me the the Jeremy Clark skiff essentials.
Okay. Essentials. Well, I've got to have a camera on board or I feel naked. I've got to have a camera on board. The turtle box has been a staple of every outing since I've come across those guys. We listen to a lot of music on the skiff. That's a huge just part of what we do and what we enjoy. And we've proven, we've been on the fence for a while about, can you pull a flat, with music blaring and still see redfish? And the answer is yes, you can. Now, maybe you don't see as many. I don't know. I don't have really a real control group to base that off of. But yeah, definitely good music. We like to eat well, whether that be something really simple or kind of going all out, and we do that. And I'm not scared to throw some extra things and take some extra time on the skiff. So whether that be, I had a rule last year and then this year that I don't do a flood tide without a watermelon. Just something I just did. But in my particular skiff, I have one sort of dry storage area. It's in the coffin box in the middle. There's no hatches or anything in the boat. Really simple. I love how Harry builds his skiffs. But that's got camera equipment and all that. I don't want to put a watermelon in there. So if you put it on the deck, it just rolls around. So I got these like little cylinder sandbags that are meant for like laying at the foot of your garage door to keep water out if it floods or something. And I sewed them in a circle. And so it's like a donut, like a GPS donut, like they used to have on your dash. And I just throw it in the boat and you put a watermelon in it and it stays exactly where you put it. So I think that's an essential. And I've got a relatively new one that I've just fallen in love with. And I'd bought a piece of fake grass, like AstroTurf.
Yeah.
And I cut it to fit and I just laid it in the boat and we've had it in the last couple of trips and it is phenomenally good.
Yeah, I saw that. I need a, I didn't know if that was like for fun or if there was a real deep functional purpose there. Sell us on the Jeremy Clark AstroTurf floor deck.
Man, you walk across it in your bare feet and it'll sell itself. It just feels good. There's nothing wrong without it, but things don't roll around. I had been toying with, putting C-Deck down, and that's a great option, but, things are quiet. If you set a reel down to re-rig something, I'm pretty hard on my gear, but there's a couple reels I take pretty good care of and don't want to, get them all marred up, and I didn't have anything in the bottom. Now you can just lay it down there. But it just feels phenomenal on your feet.
Yeah, we'll call it redneck sea deck.
Oh yeah, it absolutely is.
Tyler at Castaway, he might want to get in his own line of.
There you
custom, you get your logo in there and that's everything.
So my wife made the, she said, well, you put a Zealand logo on everything else. How are you going to do it here? Messing with me? And I said, I'll take a pair of hair clippers and just trim out like a Zealand logo in the front of this.
You gotta just do the front of the spray paint thing. It'll look like a football field.
Oh, do that. Yeah, somebody told me I need to put hashtags on it. Hash marks.
Hashtag. Yeah, you could do it. You could find a way, man. There's always a way.
Well, so when I was in the Marine Corps, we had four of us went in and bought a short school bus. And it was my daily driver for 2 years. And we covered the outside of it in green AstroTurf. And so that's been many years ago. We sported that thing around for a while and it was really obnoxious. But
was there a reason for the AstroTurf on the outside?
Yeah, it was primer gray from the guy we bought it from. And we were thinking about painting it, but we didn't have like, you know, we were going to paint it outside by our apartment. We're like, that's just going to look horrible. So we were like, let's cover it in shag carpet or something. Somebody said that. So we went and looked, and shag carpet was like really expensive. But while we looked at that, there was a remnant roll of that really short green AstroTurf stuff. And so we bought that and like a 5-gallon bucket of liquid nails and putty knives, and we went to town, and the whole thing was covered in green AstroTurf.
You might be the first person to ever go, I think I'm going to paint this. You know what? I don't want it to look bad.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's put green AstroTurf on it.
Yeah, the progression, just to be safe. The progression of that decision-making did not make any sense at all. But yeah, no, I saw this idea for the stuff in the bottom of the boat from a friend of a friend, actually. And when I saw that, I thought, why in the world didn't I think about that? I covered an entire bus in that stuff. Why have I not thought of using that here in the skiff? But yeah, it's been fun. It's been in there for like a week, so the jury's still out, but it's fun.
As your friend, I'll make sure Harry doesn't see that.
Yeah.
We all know how Harry would feel.
He's not going to like that.
Be a fan of that.
Yeah, I had
he would. You never know.
I had a conversation with him about cup holders one time, and yeah, he was not a fan.
Yeah, yeah. I deal with that regularly. he's very focused on it being a tool. Here's my last question. So
okay.
I like to ask my guest this. So with everything that you've gone through in life right now, the incredible people that you've got to meet and fish with, the incredible places you've got to go, the business you've built, all of that, if you could go back to that kid running around Virginia and give him one little piece of advice to help him along the way, what would it be?
This might be where you have to edit out a pause, because I'm going to think for just 2 seconds. One piece of advice to younger me. You know, I think I might say, you know, don't wait as long on things to happen, and be a little more aggressive, you know, for the things that you want. You know, if you're a little more aggressive to those things and you don't wait so much for them to come to you, you can positively affect those. And, you know, some of the things that I have in mind just myself or within relation to myself are things that have brought me great, great, great joy in my life. And there's no reason to put that off.
Well, Jeremy, thanks so much for hanging out with us today. I hope that we can do a part two. I think most people are gonna want to hear the other side of the Antarctica story,
right?
Amongst other things, you know, there's a lot of things that we could have got into that we left on the table. But thanks so much just for sharing all these great insights and your story. And I really appreciate it, and I enjoyed it. And thanks for being a part.
Yeah, Hunter, thanks for having me, man. It's fun. The time has flown by. I'm looking at the timer now, and it doesn't feel like we've been on here very long at all. But yeah, it's a pleasure being a part of it, and thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thanks again for listening to The Captain's Collective. Please help us out by leaving a review on iTunes and sharing this podcast. We hope that you enjoy. This is The Captain's Collective.